Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening. This is part 18 of our Jewish history course, and it's the Jews of England and Germany whom we're going to discuss this evening. The truth is, after researching this period of history, I came to one conclusion, and that is, it's absolutely miraculous that we actually survived it, that there is such a thing as a Jew. Perhaps there were two occasions in the entire history of the Jewish people where it's miraculous we survived, full stop. Yeah, the Holocaust was a great cemetery of our history. However, there were Jews in America. It was highly unlikely that Hitler was going to pursue his atrocities across the Atlantic, so there was always going to be that safe haven. But I think we can highlight two occasions in history where it's just miraculous we survived as a nation, full stop. The first, perhaps, is at the times of the destruction of the Second Temple, where it was certainly well within the Roman power to totally decimate the Jews. And I think the second time is in the Middle Ages, because if we have a look at it, starting through the Crusades, whether you're in Spain, Germany, whichever part of Europe, I mean, there was very small numbers of Jews in Israel, and the Jewish communities of Babylon had now declined. The bulk of world Jewry was then in Europe, and yet I came to the conclusion after researching, and I think you'll agree with me at the end of this evening, it's just phenomenal that the Jews survived all that. Let's start off close to home this evening with the Jews of England in the Middle Ages. It is said that the first Jews came to England as traders with Julius Caesar, or thereabouts in Roman times. In fact, others say that much before that, even in the times of King Solomon, he sent Jews, or at least Jewish merchants, as far as the British Isles. However, in 1066, which is of course moving much closer, it's in our millennium, or perhaps, sorry, in the last millennium. Good evening. Good evening, Philip. In 1066, when of course, who got it in the eye? Harold. Good old, sorry, no offence, Harold. Good old Harold got it in the eye. And the Normans invaded with William the Conqueror. He invited a group of Jews from Rouen in northern France to cross the Channel and settle in the United Kingdom. So really, that was the beginning of the first substantial community of Jews in the United Kingdom. They settled in London, Oxford, Norwich, and Lincoln. And as was the custom in those days, it was up to the protector, the king, whose chattel was the Jew, to grant a special charter of protection to the Jews, and that they could, in fact, he needed to delineate their area of involvement, what they could or could not be involved in. And it was Henry I who granted this special charter to the Jews of London, and they grew into, I would say, somewhat of a respectable commercial middle class community. And the truth is, England was a safe haven to the first two Crusades. So again, we find a fascinating thing that in a time where one area or one part of the world, one country is being destroyed, there is always another where there's a safe haven. The Jews were always allowed that by divine providence. It was, however, in 1144 that the first anti-Jewish atrocity was committed. And this, in fact, was a first in many ways, because it was the first blood libel. The libelous story of the Jews taking a Christian child and offering it, taking its blood for use in the masses over Pesach. which is ridiculous on two accounts. Number one, that we're not allowed to eat blood, and number two, we're not allowed to have anything else but flour and water in our matzahs. The Jews, because the Christians were not allowed to charge interest to their fellow men, a law borrowed, quote unquote, from the Old Testament and readapted to their Christian neighbors, in fact it did the double on us, in the sense that the halacha is, the Jewish law is, that we're in fact not allowed to charge another Jew interest, but you are allowed to charge a non-Jew interest. Well, they just reverted the law. They said that Christians are not allowed to charge each other interest, but you are allowed to charge a Jew interest, or the other way around, the Jew is allowed to take interest from you. So the Jews became moneylenders. And the largest city in England at that time was, of course, good old London. And London even had a cemetery in the 1100s. Other Jewish communities were set up in Canterbury, in York, Stratford, Windsor and Reading. So in fact those were the really oldest Jewish communities in England. 1158, Ibn Ezra, Abun Avram Ibn Ezra, the great writer and poet of whom we've spoken about of Spanish fame, he came to visit England. There were students of the Tosafists of Rabbeinu Tam, a man called Rabbi Yaakov of Orleans, in fact, opened up a yeshiva in London, and another Tosafist called Reb Binyamin in Canterbury. In 1189, however, the situation changed. This was the watershed, the turning point for the Jews in England, and it was, and we have in fact mentioned this episode beforehand, we're now reviewing it. It was at the coronation of Richard the Lionheart. A delegation of Jews were invited to Westminster Abbey for the coronation. Could you imagine? Who remembers the coronation of Queen Elizabeth? And I'm sure the chief rabbi at the time was perhaps present, not necessarily in Westminster Abbey, but perhaps outside or in the following reception. And of course the Jews, to show their allegiance, the king brought a sum of money, precious gifts. However, at the coronation of Richard the Lionhearted in 1189, it was the Archbishop of Westminster Abbey who advised the king to rebuff the Jews. He said, don't admit them in and don't accept their gifts. Richard obeyed. It was his coronation day. That was the, I suppose, protocol, the right thing to do. You've got to listen to the Archbishop on the day of your coronation. And when the Jews were rebuffed and their presents were sent back, the mob outside took this as the green light to rough them over a little bit. Well, they went a bit too far. They set fire to Jewish homes and tried to forcibly baptize many of them. Belatedly, of course, the king woke up to what was going on, and of course denied that he had anything to do with it, and issued a proclamation of civil protection to the Jews in his kingdom. However, he gallivanted off very soon after his coronation on the First Crusade, and when he did so, riots broke out against the Jews in England. Of course, in 1190, we have mentioned this, the massacre took place at York, rather the suicide of the Jews in Clifford's Tower took place in York. Richard, in fact, when he came back from the crusade, was quite enraged at this, not so much because never the poor Jews have died, it's because the records of the Jewish debt, in other words, how much money was owed to the Jews, which, of course, if the Jew disappears by some means or other, is immediately transferred to the crown, went missing. So this, of course, was a great loss of revenue to the king. The king had lost his main tax benefactors. Or, is that the right word? His main tax givers, the ones who were the giving of the tax. Contributors, yeah. And he was very annoyed at that. But never mind about that. Let's overlook it. Just carry on taxing the remaining Jews. In fact, in 1211, because of this oppressive taxation, a number of English rabbis left and went on Aliyah. So if you want, although we were let in officially in 1066 already, about 50 years later, some of the Jews found it a bit too much and had in fact gone to Israel. With the reign of Henry III in 1216, their condition grew worse. In 1230, a third of the property of the Jews in England was levied as a tax to the crown. In 1273, it's recorded that the Jews of this country gave £400,000 in tax to the king. That's a lot of money today. Well, I would suppose there's 300,000 Jews in England today. That's a pound a Jew today, if we want to say a poll tax. But could you imagine then, when they had a much smaller community? Also, the decrees of the Lateran Council that had been made by the Pope were also enforced in England. The Jew badge was enforced. The Jews were forbidden to build synagogues. And any application of the Jews to go on Aliyah at that stage was refused. They were, in fact, they were locked in. They couldn't get out, and they couldn't survive where they were. In 1255, there was the famous story of the Lincoln blood libel, a story of a blood libel, a Christian child, Hugh of Lincoln. And in fact, this has become one of the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the story of the blood libel of Hugh of Lincoln. Civil war broke out in Britain in 1262. Of course, civil war anywhere was never good for the Jews, because either side blamed them as supporting the other side. And the Jews of London specifically were blamed for supporting one side and not the other. 1,500 Jews were murdered in London and their homes were looted. And finally, in 1290, a decree was issued for all the Jews to leave England within 3 months. And over 16,500 Jews left in 1290, in fact, not to return until the middle of the 1600s, when the Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell let us back in. So that was the brief stay of the Jews in England from 1066 to 1290, a period of around about 200 years, of where the Jews had a brief stay in this country, however heavily taxed and full of blood libels. I think that the only remnants that we have today of that stay in England is Clifford's Tower in York, which we can still go there today and look at, Chaucer's Tales, and I'm not sure whether there's any remnants of the Jewish community in London left from that era. I think that the earliest thing that we do have in London today is the shul in Bevis Marks, and that was built by the Spanish and Portuguese community, which was allowed back by Cromwell when he let the Jews back in. Of course, I think I've mentioned beforehand that itself was on had a messianic idea attached to it, because it was who was it that persuaded Oliver Cromwell? Menashe ben Yisrael, he persuaded Oliver Cromwell, because he said that the Messiah wouldn't come, in fact, until all the Jews had reached all the islands of the earth. And Cromwell's a Quaker, wasn't he? Was he a Quaker or was he a Puritan? He was a Puritan, but he was a very devout believer of the Bible and so on and so forth, and let the Jews back in. Let's now transfer for the rest of the evening to Germany. I never really understood why the Jews are so fanatical about living in Germany. Even today, I can't understand how so many Jews are going back. There's 100,000 Jews today in Germany, 50 years after the Holocaust. But if you...
A lot from Russia.
A lot from Russia, yeah, from Eastern Europe. Okay, for economic reasons, I can understand. But read the period of history that we're going to look at this evening. And I often think what the Jews were doing there in the 18th and 19th centuries. Perhaps it's because we just didn't have anywhere else to go. The period following the Crusades in Germany in the 12th and 13th centuries was a period marked by civil and social deterioration of the Jewish communities. Anti-Semitism really could only be checked by a strong monarch. If you had a king or a duke, as the Americans call it, a duke who could control the masses, then the Jews were protected. And if not, they were left open to anybody who wanted them. Of course, that came with a price. You had to pay the monarch to protect you. So the Jew became the property of the state. They had to pay unusual taxes in addition to the taxes levied on all the inhabitants of the land. They had to pay protection tax. The Jews of Frankfurt, for example, had to provide, as part of their protection tax, all the parchments which were used in the German chancellery, besides all the linen for bedroom materials and utensils for the royal kitchens. So that was part of their protection tax. If a Jew wanted to travel from one town to the other, then you had to pay a Jew toll. Because you were a Jew and you were moving from one place to another, you had to pay a toll because you are a Jew. Since the decrees of the Lateran Council were enforced, the Jews were obvious, they had to wear a badge, and therefore it was quite easy to catch the Jew moving from one town to the other, and therefore you levied him. Blood libels were, by the end of the 13th century, an annual occurrence. In 1247, Pope Innocent IV issued a papal edict that basically stated that the blood libel has no base to it. The Pope said that the blood libel is ridiculous. That was in 1247. That's not bad. That's about 103 years after the first one. Well, they woke up at least 103 years later and said that it has no base. But I'm afraid that had zero effect, because they continued. In 1241, does anybody know what happened in Germany in 1241? Somebody invaded. Lots of Asia came through Russia, came through Poland and touched on Germany. Tar very much if you know the answer, ladies and gentlemen. That was the clue. It was the Tartars. Genghis Khan, the Mongols and the Tartars. And of course, who were they? Well, they were no less, of course, than the 10 lost tribes of Israel, weren't they? And it was the Jews, of course, who were financing them. Or so the rumours circulated in Germany. And of course, because of that, the Jews suffered terribly. What with a name like Khan, what do you want? After the death of Frederick II, in Germany, civil war broke out. Now, the story of of the control of the emperor, king, or the Kaiser in Germany was, one, that when you had central power, he controlled the Jews. When central power was lost, then the Jews were controlled by all the princes or dukes of all the little townlets and areas. After the death of Frederick II, a terrible civil war broke out in Germany, and basically imperial government collapsed. And you had a situation for 19 years in Germany when there was no recognized empire. Basically, anarchy reigned. This period was called the interregnum, sort of in between monarchs. you had at that time between 10 and 20,000 Jews in Germany at the complete mercy of the German barons. They were literally at their whims, life or death. It really was irrelevant to the German barons as long as they got their monies. In 1273, the situation changed. A man called Rudolf of Habsburg, he was chosen by the German princes to reassume some central government, some central imperial title. And he took, again, advantage of his Jewish subjects, and he took terrific loans to finance his empire, we're told, particularly from a very wealthy Jew called Ansel Oppenheimer. This Jew called Ansel Oppenheimer lent Rudolf a huge amount of money, probably never to see it again. Rudolf was powerful enough to put an end to the bloody persecutions, but any mark of favour to any of the Jews always came with a tremendous price. The emperor had to be a diplomat. You need the money, but you can't offend the local populace. So you've got to give the Jew a little bit of free rein, but at the same time restrict him enough to keep the clergy at bay. So it was quite a diplomatic balance, a balancing game which the emperor had to play with his Jews. So, on the one hand, for example, in the town of Regensburg, the Jews were afforded a protection, royal protection. Yet at the same time, the king, or the emperor, agreed to the bishop's request that the Jews remained off the streets during the Easter week. Blood libels did continue in Germany. In 1285, 100 Jews in Munich were burned to death. And serious incidences of violence really erupted at that time along the Rhine. I must say, let me just talk about a particular personality at this time, but his personality and his death is indicative of the period. One of the great Jews of that particular period was called Maharam Mirotenberg, the Rabbi Meir of the town of Rotenburg. He was born in Worms, in Vermeza, in 1215. He was educated in the yeshiva in Würzburg in Paris, in Würzburg in Germany, and he in fact went to Paris to study under the famous Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. You may remember, we mentioned him because he had this tremendous disputation between him and the French clergy as to the authenticity of the Talmud and whether the Talmud was anti-Christian, and that disputation, as we mentioned then, was a foregone conclusion. Unfortunately, the 24 cartloads of Talmud manuscripts were burned in Paris at the time, and the Rabbi Meir was there together with his teacher Rabbi Yechiel when that happened. He returned to Germany, went to Rotenburg, and he opened a yeshiva. He had personal investments and a business which he prospered tremendously with, and he supplied all the needs of all his students, and he in fact built up an institution where he had students flocking to him from all over Europe. In fact, some of the greatest of his students, one of them was called the Rosh, whom we mentioned went later to Spain, and the Mordechai. Really, he was the leading Torah authority of Germany at that particular time. There are over 1,000 responsa of his preserved today, of the Maharam Mirotenberg, which we still have today. So he was the recognized halachic authority of Germany at the time. But let's blend this in with history and see what happened to him personally. As we mentioned, there had been these serious outbreaks of violence along the Rhine communities at this time, and the Jews decided that to get out of this quagmire of violence, they were again to emigrate back to one land which again they always felt was their own, and that was to go back to Israel. The spiritual leader of Germany, this Rabbi Meir, the son of Baruch of Rotenburg, He led the Exodus. However, when they reached Italy, Rabbi Meir was recognized by a baptized Jew who was traveling with the Bishop of Basel at the time. And this baptized Jew recognized this fellow who was...
They're the worst.
Recognized, hey, he says, what's the chief rabbi of Rottenburg leading a whole bunch of people to go to Israel? Rabbi Meir was seized and he was sent back to Emperor Rudolf in 1286. Now, Rudolf was incensed. What's my chattels doing running away? You're going to take my taxation away. So what he did is he stuck Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg in a fortress in Alsace and basically confined him there. And he confined him there until Rabbi Meir died in 1293. That's not the end of the story. The community, the Jewish community, offered 20,000 marks, which was a huge sum of money, to Rudolf to get the rabbi out alive. That didn't help. He thought, why should he give the money if all he needs to do is to confiscate the property anyway? But it didn't end with his lifetime. By the way, one advantage of his incarceration was that he was allowed to write as he was incarcerated, and the manuscripts of what he did write survived. Quite miraculously, as you'll see in a minute. So he edited much of his life's works, and it is preserved even today. I've got books here, the Meir Motter of Rottenburg, of which he did write then. However, even after he died, Rudolf would still not release his body. And it was only 14 years after his death, in the year 1307, when a Jew called Alexander Suskind negotiated the release of the body of Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg for an astronomic sum of money, and finally his body was laid to rest in the cemetery in Worms, of where it's still there today. In fact, it's a nice sequel to the story that this Jew Alexander Suskind requested that he be buried next to Rabbi Meir, because at the end of the day he had bailed him out at least for a kosher burial. But here we see an interesting thing. Rabbi Meir, do you remember when I told you that 20,000 marks was offered for his ransom? It was chiefly Rabbi Meir himself who encouraged the Jews not to send the money. Why? Because he argued that if they're going to ransom us in this manner, then it will cause them to seize other rabbinic authorities, and the same will happen. And here we have an interesting halachic precedent of a rabbi encouraging the community not to bail him out, not to ransom him, for fear lest it may happen in other communities as well. Now there is this is brought in fact halacha lemaisa. What happens, for example, if a sefer Torah chas v'shalom is stolen from a synagogue, and a ransom of, let's say in today's terms, £50,000 is, God forbid it happened, you know, in one of the communities in South London, a sefer Torah went missing from the ark. And a letter was received by the synagogue, if you don't deliver £50,000 to this and this address, in 2 weeks' time, the sefer Torah will be burned. God forbid. And if you go to the authorities, we'll burn it immediately. What do you do? Do you give the money? If you give the money, there's a chance they may do it again. If you don't give the money, then the sefer Torah will be burned. Well, thank God, this is not a common occurrence today. However, it was a very common occurrence then, since all the property, both personal and in terms of scrolls, manuscripts, which were the Jews' lifeline, were the chattels of the emperors and the dukes. This is what they did. They ransomed both people, and particularly this time coming out of the responsa which we have from that period. You should know a lot of Jewish history is learned from the questions and answers which were asked to rabbis who wrote down the questions which they were asked and had to reply to them based on Talmudic sources. But we learn a lot about the history from the time, from those questions and answers. Germany, although it was the most turbulent time, produced, even in these very difficult years, some great scholars, in addition to the Maharam of Rottenburg. One other of note was a man called Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, Rabbi Yehuda the Pious. Now, this has nothing to do with the Hasidic movement. The Hasidic movement only came later in the 18th century. He was a man called Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid because he wrote a book called Sefer Hasidim, the Book of the Pious, stressing piety and devoutness in face of persecution. He wrote a book all about preserving one's ethical and moral high ground, even when you're surrounded by immoral and crass people. And he wrote a book about the willingness to sacrifice one's life, even to the extent of martyrdom, public, rather than conversion. A book much needed in his time, and a masterpiece even when read today. At the end of the 13th century and the first half of the 14th century in Germany, saw a period of intense persecution. The Jews were driven from town to town and murdered really at the slightest pretext. In 1298, in Rottingen, in the province of Franconia, a very strange story happened. Sacrificial wafers used in church, in a church ritual, were found to have red spots on them. The Jews were accused of boiling these sacrificial wafers so that they bled. And there was a ruthless nobleman called Rindfleisch, who incited really the mob to retaliate against this terrible Jewish subterfuge. And he was so successful that he managed to get the mob to take the entire community of Rottingen at that time and to burn them alive at the stake. In the next 6 months, this Rindfleisch rampaged from town to town throughout Germany, exterminating a total, it's estimated, of 100,000 Jews. 140 Jewish communities were destroyed, including the communities of Würzburg and Nuremberg, and only the Jewish communities of Regensburg and Augsburg were spared. And it was at this time that the Rosh, I think I mentioned to you, Rabbeinu Osher, he left at this time to Spain because he could no longer take the persecutions in Germany. These events, unfortunately, were repeated again in the year 1336 to the year 1338. In those 2 years, an organized group of bandits, ruffians, called the Armleders, A-R-M-L-E-D-E-R. In fact, they were called that because of a leather band which they wore around the arm. Isn't that reminiscent of some other band which was worn around the arm? And perhaps, I'm not sure, I've never seen this, but perhaps that was in fact the source of wearing a band around the arm to identify. These arm leaders did attack the Jewish communities of southwest Germany. They were led by some nobleman who had a vision. And in this vision, he was shown in his divine vision to... It was a divine vision which basically directed him to avenge the crucifixion of J.C., by killing off as many Jews as he possibly could. He got together this group of around 5,000 peasants with pitchforks and they massacred the communities of Alsace, Rhineland, Swabia. Some of the dukes, as we said, condemned them and protected their Jews, and others openly joined in. Again, there was no central power which afforded the Jews protection. The Jews were very much under the whim of the local populace. However, the worst was yet to come. And the worst happened in the year 1348. Because in that year, 1348, the Black Death swept through Europe. Now, little is known of the origins of the plague. However, it's suggested by historians that this was a plague which was carried by rats into the communities, and since there was very little knowledge of hygiene, and that people didn't bathe in those days, and there was, hygiene was almost non-existent, it was carried and spread rapidly throughout all the communities of Europe. In fact, in the 2 years between 1348 and 1350, a quarter of the entire population of Europe died because of this plague. Now, you need a scapegoat. In any disaster, human nature is to look for a scapegoat. Rumors spread that it was the Jews who had poisoned wells and rivers. And this was encouraged by the fact that there were less deaths in the Jewish community from the plague than in the surrounding communities. Now, the fact is that Jews have always practiced a certain level of hygiene. For example, Natilas Yadayim, you wash your hands when you wake up in the morning. You wash your hands before you eat a meal. It was customary to bathe, not just customary, the halacha says that one should bathe before Shabbos. Bathing was almost unheard of people in the Middle Ages. They just didn't do it. Jews bathed before Shabbos. Women attended the mikveh. There was a level of hygiene, and that is probably why there was much less of a scourge of the plague by the Jews than of the non-Jews. However, the anti-Semites came up with the following charge. They said, "You know what the Jews have done? It originated in Spain," they said. "It's the Jews of Toledo upon whom they placed the blame on." By the way, what happened was, as we'll soon see, that it was in Switzerland, in a place called Chillon, the local authorities got a bunch of Jews, tortured them, and got them to confess to what they told them. What did they tell them? They told them the following. They told them that the Jews of Toledo in Spain, they'd concocted a lethal poison of spiders, lizards, human flesh, and dough of Christian consecrated wafers. Could you imagine? This is like a Saddam Hussein poison gas, putting in the poison all the ingredients, you know, which human flesh and consecrated wafers, that's Christianity, all mixed in. It's like this kill pill. Really, with the Jews, and they'd carried that out of Spain and poisoned with it the wells and the rivers of Europe. Well, the Jews of Chillon unfortunately confessed to their crime, and in that community where they did confess, the entire Jewish community, men, women, and children, were burnt at the stake with a Sefer Torah. Now, since they'd confessed, well, the Jews had agreed that they'd done it, therefore the story spread like wildfire through the Rhine, Alsace, Austria, and Poland, and Jews were massacred by the thousands, because they were the source of the plague. The Pope, gotta give him his credit, Clement VI, issued a papal edict prohibiting arbitrary killing of Jews. Again, of no effect. it's interesting, when papal edicts, when they were restraints, almost had fell on deaf ears. When they were of a inflammatory nature, spread like wildfire. Now again, the Emperor of Germany at this time, Charles IV, he was very fearful of losing his income which he gained from the Jews. So he tried to protect the Jews. There was an interesting story which took place in Strasbourg. In Strasbourg, the mayor, and in fact the entire council of the town, undertook to protect their Jews because they were important sources of revenue. However, the mob didn't agree with them, so they deposed the mayor, changed the council, and on a particular Shabbos dragged the 1,800 Jews of Strasbourg to the local cemetery and burned them alive. And all their property was confiscated. And this is how it went on, community after community, in Germany at that time, at the time of the plague. And as I said right at the opening of this evening, it's quite amazing to think of how the Jews survived this period at all. There was a non-Jewish historian of this period, a man called Klosener of Strasbourg, and he wrote the following words: "It is not the poison in the wells that killed the Jews, but it was their wealth." Isn't that an interesting sentence? In other words, because the Jews were wealthy, people were jealous, that killed them. It wasn't the poison in the wells. I've often pointed out, anti-Semitism is irrational. We've been killed because we've been too wealthy, and therefore we're envied. We've been killed because we're too poor, and therefore we are leeches, and we suck the state dry of its funds. Whatever we do is no good. No win situation. The attacks of 1348 in the times of the plague weren't just a rabble doing it. They were systematic attacks. City councils convened, decided who was to get whose property, and then they began an attack. Got rid of the Jews and divided it as pre-planned. So in fact, it was a very calculated business. There were a group of Christians at this time who didn't help things. They were called the flagellants. This is a very interesting phenomenon. They decided that, of course, you have to do teshuva, you have to repent in the face of such a plague. And how do you repent? Well, one of the ways of doing repentance is self-infliction. So they would go around and get themselves flogged in a marketplace and hope that this would invoke divine mercy, as God seeing them, so to speak, being afflicted. And they, of course, at the same time incited the masses and says one of the ways, of course, to repent is to get rid of the Jews. And they were, or so to speak, their involvement in this whole time period was of a terrible inflammatory nature. The truth is, atrocities had taken place across Europe, but nowhere was it as systematic and thoroughly with anti-Semitic feelings as in Germany. We had an interesting phenomenon at this time. The Jews of Worms, Frankfurt, Oppenheim and Mayence, instead of succumbing to the crowds, in fact set fire to their own homes and died in the flames. In Mayence, 6,000 Jews died in martyrdom. So in fact this communal suicide at York was not in fact a one-off story. We often, it's interesting, if you ask people, give me examples of suicide throughout Jewish history, who was the first one to commit suicide, for example, a lot of people might say it was King Saul. He fell on his sword in battle rather than being given up to the Philistines. This in fact is the halachic precedent for committing suicide. You're not allowed to commit suicide. You're not a nobody's in, a person is given their body to take care of. It's not theirs to dispose of. A person is forbidden to commit suicide. The question is, how could King Saul do so? Although we do have times in history, the earliest one perhaps, one of the earlier times, Masada, where Jews did en masse commit suicide instead of the chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name, without him giving up to the enemy. What we must realize is that at York, that was another example, but very few people are aware that throughout the Middle Ages, in Germany, this was a common occurrence. In Nuremberg, due to the flagellants, the Jews were burnt alive in a large plaza area called the Judenbull, the Jews' Hill, they called it. In all at that time, due to the plague and the rumours which were spread, 60 large communities and 150 smaller communities were totally exterminated in Germany. Now, the decimation of the Jewish communities, of course, created a void, an economic void. The financial structure of Jewish banking, of what they were, that was their forte, collapsed. And there was tremendous revenue which was lost. And therefore, in the years after the plague, many of the princes started clamouring for the return of the Jews. All is forgiven, Jews. Come back. We need you. Well, we need your money. In 1356, a new constitution of the German Empire called the Golden Bull was brought into effect. Much of the power of the emperor was yielded to the princes, and each prince had the right to decide whether which Jews and how many Jews he was to take into his kingdom. But the legal status of the Jews changed for the worse. It was at this stage, in the middle of the 1350s and on, that Jews were told to live in Judengassen, Jewish streets, otherwise known as ghettos. In these Judengassen, Jews were not allowed to go out from dusk until daybreak. And the least provocation of the local community caused riots. Listen to this terrible incident. In 1389 in Prague, on Easter Sunday, a Catholic clergyman passed through a Judengasse, and some kids were playing around. Now, you know how kids can play around and they can... kids are kids! And they obviously said something to annoy this fellow. He was enraged, and he incited a mob, and things got totally out of proportions. The synagogue in Prague was destroyed, 3,000 Jews were killed. A pogrom. Their property was confiscated by the emperor. And when an appeal was made, like, you know, this is for nothing, the emperor replied, well, the Jews shouldn't have stepped out of their homes on Easter Sunday. The emperor went further. He proclaimed all Jewish debts cancelled. He proclaimed the Jews his personal possessions, and he forbade them to leave the country. In 1399, a baptized Jew called Peter made a new accusation, and he said that in the Aleinu prayer in the synagogues, which we say right at the end of davening, Aleinu. In fact, in Ashkenaz communities, we say two paragraphs of the Aleinu. In Sephardic, they only say one paragraph of the Aleinu. But everyone does say Aleinu. It's a universal prayer. This Peter, who was a baptized Jew, made an accusation that the Aleinu prayer contained an allusion which was very abusive to JC. And there was a whole disputation as to whether it did or did not. In fact, not in the Ashkenaz text, but in the Chabad text, let me tell you a very interesting thing. In the Chabad text of the Aleinu, we insert a few words which is not there in the Ashkenaz text, and I'm not sure whether it's there in the Sephardic. We say, Aleinu l'shabech l'adeinu akel l'seis gudol l'yetzev reish l'yassonu k'goy ha'ratzviz, who you haven't made us like the nations of Alei Samanu k'mishpachos ha'adon, sheheim mishtachavim lehevel v'lorik, because they bow down to vanity and nothingness. And in fact, it was the custom of many to spit on the floor when they said those words. Now, believe it or not, you are allowed to spit inside a synagogue. My father reminds me that in the Hayes Shul, which was a shul on Cheetham Hill Road, going back in the 1930s, there was a special spittoon which they had in the middle of the shul, which all the old fogies would go in the middle of davening. You had this special spittoon which somebody had given, and it was the custom of many communities when they reached these words, Shehem Mishtachavim Lahevel Valarik, they would actually spit on the floor at that point in Aleinu. Now this Peter, well, he took that, whom are they referring to? None less than JC. And a rabbi, a famous rabbi called Rabbi Yomtzev Lipman, was called to refute this claim. Of course he tried to refute it, but 70 Jews got killed and 3 burned at the stake, just to prove the point. Unfortunately, at this time, there was a great spiritual decline, as you can imagine, because the communities were so ravaged, and because the Jews were so massacred, the concentrations and the ability to sit and study in a tranquil state diminished, and there were very few scholars around. Now this is an interesting historical fact. Listen to this. In the year 1380, two great rabbis of Vienna, a man called Rabbi Meir ben Baruch Halevi and the other one called Reb Avraham Klausner, two widely respected scholars, said the following. You know what was happening? The local dukes and princes were appointing rabbis of their own. But these weren't real rabbis. They were tax collectors. These were chief rabbis, no less, which they'd say, okay, listen here, Jew, you be my chief rabbi. Now, Jews got to listen to the chief rabbi, right? So the chief rabbi, everyone has to give half of their earnings or whatever it is to me. And what was happening was, is that the level of erudition amongst the rabbis was falling rapidly. So these two rabbis in 1380 made a decree, and they said that only somebody upon whom has been conferred the title Moreinu, Moreinu means our teacher, is allowed to be a rabbi in a community. Now that term stuck. For example, if you will go to, in most shuls today, when they call the rabbi up for Moreinu Harav, the rabbi knows. When you call up the Rav for an aliyah, you'll say, Ya'amoid Moreinu Harav. He should stand up, Moreinu, our guide, the Rav. Now this term, Moreinu, was an institution of 1380 by these two rabbis. And let me just tell you a little bit about smicha, because, you know, this is knocked around. Have you got smicha? You've not got smicha. What was smicha? Originally, in the Bible, we're told that Moses rested his hands on Joshua. That was called smicha. Smicha means literally to rest. It was a conferring of the qualification to rule and the qualification to pass judgment. Now, smicha, originally in Talmudic times, was only given to great, great, great students, people who could become members of the Sanhedrin. And it had to be given by somebody who had smicha from a previous generation. You can't just wake up one day and say, well, I happen to be a great genius, I know the whole of the Talmud, and you can test me, and I can now become a rabbi. No, you had to have smicha. In fact, we're told that the famous Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great rabbis, conferred smicha upon a few students. It was only a select few that ever got smicha. However, that smicha stopped after the demise of the Babylonian communities, and having said that, it did linger on till the 13th, 14th centuries, but by about this time, particularly in Germany, because there was such a lack of teachers, a lack of yeshivas, it was decided that, again, to reintroduce, if you want, the idea or title of smicha. Smicha means that there had to be some form of rabbinic ordination that a person had to go through in order to become a rabbi in a city. You can't become if you were appointed by the local duke to become the rabbi, that was not recognized by the masses. Okay? So, for example, if today in England, if Her Majesty the Queen appointed a chief rabbi, then that's of no significance to us. That would not be recognized by the Jewish community. Why? Because that's bias. She's doing it for her own reasons. We would appoint a chief rabbi whom we recognize as a halachic authority and a spiritual leader. And that person has to have smicha, meaning rabbinic ordination. And that person would be called Moreno. So for example, when you call up the chief rabbi, when it comes to your synagogue, even today, we call him Ya'amod Moreno, we call him Harav Haroshi, the chief rabbi. However, you call up a rabbi, you say the words Moreno Harav. And this is where it was instituted, in order to make sure that the quality of Rabbanim was as it should be. In the 15th century, as we move into the 15th century, persecution continued, but in fact the communities had been so ravaged there were very few communities left to persecute. The Emperor Sigismund of Frankfurt imported Jews for income purposes, and he said that they have to give him one half of their income. Imagine giving one half of your income to the emperor. Listen to this interesting fact. At that time, in his empire, in Frankfurt and its environments, the entire, what's it called there when you have, is it called a national gross income? In other words, the income of the entire country. What's it called? It has a name, I think. The gross domestic product, or whatever it is, the GDP. Gross national product of Frankfurt at the time was 13,000 gulden. That's how much he managed to get from all his subjects together. There were nine Jewish families in Frankfurt at the time, and they collectively had to give the emperor 5,000 gulden, which is like a third of the national tax. I'm not sure how much tax is collected here in England, right? A year. Wait, I'm not sure. Ridiculous figures. Let's say it's £1 billion, yeah? But imagine levying the Jews for £300 million as tax. Well, spread about 300,000 Jews. What's 300,000 my math is not very good. 300,000 into 3,000 million. Right? I'm not sure what that is. £1,000 each? What? Excuse me, it's too late in the night to start a thing. But a ridiculous sum, and that was in nine families who had to give it. There was a certain area of Europe, Austria, which had a bit of a respite. Now this is interesting. Austria is not far from Germany. In 1244, the Jews did receive charters ensuring their rights and privileges in Austria. And in fact, many Jews found refuge in Austria from all the tremendous persecution of Germany. So again, a sort of a safe enclave was found. And whilst they were there, the Jews had a relatively easy time. It ended abruptly in 1419. Then a young Catholic reformer called John Huss came on the scene, and he openly opposed the Catholic Church. He charged them, he said, it's riddled by corruption and the clergy are immoral. It's not new, nothing new is under the sun. And of course, he was immediately condemned as a blasphemer by the Catholic Church, and they had him executed. His followers were enraged, and they broke out in a rebellion against the Catholic Church and its forces. But what did the Catholic Church do? It spread a rumor that it was the Jews who were providing the Hussites, as they were called, with their arms and money. And a wave of massacres broke out against the Jews. In 1420, Duke Albert of Austria issued a decree: all the Jews in his kingdom were to be given the choice. Sorry, all the Jews in the kingdom were to be imprisoned and to be given the choice: either conversion or death. The Jews, as was the norm, chose death. The poor Jews were set adrift on ships in the Danube to perish. The rich Jews were imprisoned, their children were taken and baptized, and they were kept in prisons for about a year, until such time when they were publicly burned in a meadow outside Vienna. And there were many eye reports or witnesses of that event in which they said that the non-Jews were impressed that all the Jews went to their death saying the Shema. You know, I mean, this is, we know, the truth is not many people live to tell the tale, but we know that when Jews went to their death, they said the Shema. But here you had, if you want an eye report of non-Jewish people saying that they were impressed when the Jews went to their death, they said the Shema. And for many years after 1420, there were no Jews in Austria whatsoever. Austria became Judenreich. Finally, just to put the nail in the coffin of the Jews of Germany, matters were made worse by two absolutely fanatical anti-Semites. The first was a pope, Pope Eugenius IV. He made a decree, a papal edict, that Christians were not allowed to eat, drink, bathe with Jews, not to reside near them, not to use Jewish medicines, no Jew was allowed to build a synagogue, the Jews had to live in a ghetto, and to wear a badge, and the Jews were forbidden to study the Talmud. Can you imagine all that? And finally, a papal emissary, he sent somebody out to make sure that that was all done, but he sent out a Franciscan friar, a man called John of Capistrano, whose name eventually sent a shudder through any Jewish spine. He sent him to Germany. This Capistrano claimed to have superhuman powers. He proclaimed himself to be a miracle worker. And anywhere that he came, any community that he arrived in, inevitably resulted in loss of Jewish life and property. He preached in Latin, a language which the masses did not understand, but he was so mesmerizing in his oratory. Well, you know, I can imagine listening to a drosha in Latin for an hour and somebody said, what did he say? Kill the Jews. Right? It doesn't make any difference what he said. Nobody understood it anyway. There's a fascinating story of a famous rabbi. Listen to this for a bit of Jewish chutzpah. A chutzpah in hell, I would call it. Capistrano claimed to have superhuman powers and to have performed many miracles. When he reached Neustadt, the famed Rabbi Israel of Issodlane who in fact was the author of a very great halachic work called Terumas Hadeshen, challenged him to a test to determine who was indeed the righteous one. He, the Jewish rabbi, or Capistrano, the Christian priest. What was the test to be? He offered to be burned at the stake together with Capistrano and let the Almighty decide between them as to who was more righteous. The bigoted monk, of course, refused. But that, I thought, was an interesting challenge. And the rabbi says, you know what, I've got a good idea. Let's both go to the stake, and whoever wins will win. The rabbi was willing to give his life up to get rid of this guy. Despite everything we've said, there were a number of great figures in this time. We've spoken of Meir of Rothenburg. I just wanted to mention two people. One, a Jew called Rabbi Yaakov ben Moshe Maharil. Now, if you've studied Halacha, you'll know that the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserlich, the famous commentator of Krakow, Poland, often quotes the Maharil. The Maharil was the head of the Jewish community in Mayence at the time, and he wrote a book called Sefer HaMinhagim, the Book of Customs, in which he brings down and elucidates and informs us of many of the customs of the Jewish community in Germany. In fact, there is a family of Jews who live in South London who are called McGrill. Lenny McGrill is a member of the Richmond community. In fact, just round the corner here is a man who is a McGrill. And they are direct descendants of the Maharil. It's just that G and H is interchanged. Mogilev, Mohilev. In Russian, they can't say so they say a G. Hommel, Gommel. It's an H and G. Kahan is Kagan. H and G are interchangeable. And they are descendants of him. He was an important person because it's from him that we got to know of all the customs of Germany. You see, because when eventually the code of Jewish law was finally put together, you'll see, when I talk about it, it was put together in two parts. One part being the Sephardic customs, and the other the Ashkenazic customs, but the Maharil was an important contributor. And the other one was this Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, the author of the Terumas Hadeshen, who challenged this Capistrano to a contest. That basically brings us to the end of Jewish history of Germany, till the beginning of the 15th, till the beginning of the 15th century. Next week, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, we're going to perhaps have a brief look at the Jews of Italy and then, in fact, what I'm going to do is we're going to have a bit of a break from the German and European crisis and unbelievable suffering, and take a bit of a breath of fresh air, because we're going to move over to Israel, to Tzfas, where we have this renaissance of Jewish learning, and in fact the codifying of the Jewish law by Rabbi Yosef Cairo. And we'll see that was very much based upon all the scholarship of Spain and of Germany, which had been put together. But I'd like to reiterate, just in the closing few moments of this evening's shiur, to point out that tonight has been a saga of survival throughout unbelievable persecution. Something which I've said, as I pointed out, I can't think of any other era in Jewish history as much as the destruction of the Second Temple and these Middle Ages, of where it is astounding to think that there still does exist the Jew. Unless it be simply because there were enclaves at a particular time in a particular place, it could have been a year, a few months, where we could survive, where we were allowed to go. And although the dove never found a rest for its feet, yet it was never exterminated in total. This is the fulfillment, in fact, of the Torah, of the admonitions which we read in the Bible, that the Jew will never disappear. God has promised us that. And always a safe haven will be found amidst destruction. And also we've seen the total, in this time, we've seen that Jewish learning and erudition survived amongst and amidst the most difficult circumstances. And one could perhaps say that is the reason. They had nothing else to live for. If you don't have a life, so to speak, a material life, then you devote yourself at least to some spiritual pursuit, which in fact will carry you amidst all the troubles and sorrows of the period. And that's why perhaps in the Crucible we've managed to come out with some beautiful gems. And often in times of plenty we're not as productive. I would like to say, though, that to finish on a good note, that today I think it's important when we look back on the millennia of Jewish history, and often through going through the annals of history, as we have done even so far to the Middle Ages, it's amazing what the nation has been through. And today, I think it's quite right that we have, if you want, the right to say it's enough. It's enough, we've been through enough as a nation, and we have the right to acclaim, to have a land of our own. I'm not saying this as a Zionist party political broadcast, but I'm saying that if we have a land of our own, could you imagine, this is what even Theodor Herzl understood as an irreligious Jew. He understood that there must be a place which we can find a safe haven from persecution, and it can only be in our homeland, a place where the Jews will have a place of their own. And halavai, I often think that Jews today in Israel would be made aware of the history of the Jew to perhaps appreciate more what we have and realize that instead of infighting, of which we can quite capable of destroying ourselves, as we saw in the case of the Second Temple period, just before the Second Temple, where we had a commonwealth and destroyed it by infighting, halavai today we would apply the lessons of history, realize what tremendous advantage we do have today of having a land and of having a common heritage and bond with each other and love each other. This is the challenge of today. And hopefully we also have the right perhaps to turn around to Hashem and look back on that period of history and say, Hashem, you know, it's been long enough, now we need a respite, now the dove needs to come to rest, and it's Hashem with the coming of Mashiach.